I just wanted to be to start by reminding us of where we left off on Wednesday. So we had derived this real space partition function in terms of this real space field phi, where phi is a different value for each site on your real space lattice. So it's a phi I. And then this was our action in terms of phi. And then for small values of this argument, and later on we'll talk about that, but you know, you can approximate the Cauch and use the values of what the log is to get a series for the log of Cauch of x. And so if you do that for this argument beta a, and I think this is what your point was, it looks like there's a beta in there when it's really the matrix B. Yes, that is matrix B. I'll get to that in a moment. What you'll get is this approximate action where I have quadratic terms and then a linear term. We're going to call this piece the Gaussian model, and we're going to be focusing on this Gaussian part today. And then there's the fourth term, which will be phi-4 theory, which will be the extension from there. Just fix this B so that it doesn't look like a beta. Okay. So the first thing we're going to want to do is take all these pieces to momentum space. So that's what we were talking about for the second part of the Wednesday lecture. And so to recall those, we had several momentum space formulas. And we're going to use these to write things and go from real space fields to k-space fields. So I'm going to keep these here for reference, because we'll be using them several times over this lecture. So we have K space in terms of X space. And then we have the real space in terms of K space functions. And then also, we had this extension to functions that had two variables that lived in k-space. K and Q. And then the other direction as well. And your notes, by the way, also give you some continuum versions of these, because when you've been looking at field theories in other contexts, they have not been based on a spatial lattice, but instead based on continuous space. And we will talk about, you know, the next step, the continuous space, later on, but we're going to stick with the lattice for now. Everything is a lot nicer with the lattice because we don't get all these infinities and whatnot. Was there a question? Okay, well, let's jump right in with these momentum space transformations. So let's begin by asking, what is Bij in momentum space? So we can understand Bij as just a function of Xi, Xj. So we can make use of that second set of formulas that had the two variables. And so we should be able to say that BKQ and momentum space is the sum over Ij, Bij, e to the minus I, k dot xi, e to the minus I, q dot xj. And now with Bij in particular, we're going to take advantage of some of the properties that we know about it. Because what is B again? What is that B matrix telling us? It's a little annoying because it's label isn't as physically suggestive as you're used to seeing J for the interactions for the model. But what do we know about B?
Positive definite.
Say again? Yes, it is. But more than that, it's related to Jij, and that's the nearest neighbors. So it's going to be zero. Most of its entries are actually going to be zero because it's related to this Jij matrix, which only connected nearest neighbors in our lattice. And then it also had a diagonal piece. So this Bij is going to have a lot of zeros and only a few non-zeros. So we're actually going to write this out more clearly in terms of the form of Bij. So I could write this first as a sum over the diagonal pieces, because we know those are non-zero. So we're going to need to keep track of those. And for the diagonal pieces, you know that xi and xj are the same. This is just the piece of the sum when I and j are the same. So I can combine the two exponentials and say k plus q times xi. And then I'm going to have the piece where we're thinking about the nearest neighbors. So I have a sum of I and mu, where remember E mu is going to take us to all the nearest neighbors on our lattice. So this is going to have two pieces. We're going to have B of Xi connected to Xi plus E mu direction. And then I'm going to have an e to the minus I. And in this case, the first one is xi, and then the second one is xi plus e mu. So notice I'm going to have two xi pieces, and then I'm going to have an extra e sub mu piece. So I can have e k, in fact, I'll just go ahead and combine these, k plus q dot x sub I, but then I have one extra piece, which is that e sub mu, e to the minus I q dot e sub mu, and an a. I need that length scale in that, because this is a x, we're going to move one further, so now I have an extra spacing a. Okay, so that's the first piece, and that connects x to x plus e mu. What else do I need? What is left that is non-zero in this Bij matrix?
Positive definite.
Well, and you might even say, you know, don't I have everything here? But remember, we did an overcounting. We have the factor of 2 here. So we need to also connect not just x to x plus 1, but we need to connect x minus 1 to x. We need those entries as well. And I could have just put, this ends up being important in order to compute the thing. So I can also do x minus emu should also have some connection to xi. And so then I have e to the minus I k plus q dot xi. But now this x is going to have an extra piece. And it's going to be minus emu here. And so that is going to turn out to be e to the plus I q dot emu a. This is a minus to make that clear. And now we can use the fact that both of these B matrices need to be equal to each other. So I can just call them both the same thing. And then they have these terms in common. And then the only terms that are different are these two terms. So I can rewrite the first part the same as before and try to keep it from looking like a beta. And then I have the sum over I mu. And then I have B xi xi plus emu, and then they both have the e to the minus I k plus q dot xi. But then what we get is an e to the minus I q dot emu a plus an e to the plus I q dot emu a. And I should close the parentheses there. And then we can write this piece as 2 times the cosine of q in the mu direction times a. And then this BII piece, what is this? Is this the diagonal piece? Remembering our definition of BIJ. It's just going to be this lambda, right? Because this is just the same for all the diagonal entries. So we're just going to put a constant lambda there. And then this piece, again, if we're just doing our nearest neighbor Ising model, this piece is just going to be the J. This is the coupling of the nearest neighbor terms. Thank you. So we are going to get sum over I lambda e to the minus I k plus q dot xi plus, now I have a 2 coming from that 2 cosine, sum over I mu j e to the minus I k plus q dot xi cosine of q mu a. And now we have a sum over this piece. Does anyone remember what is this piece going to turn into if you do a sum over this? Remember, this is the discrete version of probably some of the things that you've seen in integrals and whatnot. So we're going to get some kind of Kronecker delta here. And we derived it a little bit last Wednesday. Well, what happens if k plus q is equal to 0? Then we get 1 here, and then we have a sum over all the sites. And how many sites are there? There are n of them. So we just get n in that case. When k is not equal to q, we're just going to get these oscillations. They're going to cancel each other out, and we're going to get 0. So what should this be equal to? We know we have a lambda still. N times the Kronecker delta of what? What does
k plus q is
0. Yeah, k plus q is 0, or you could just say k is equal to minus q. Either way. Yeah, k plus q is equal to 0 is more of the Dirac delta thing, but you can do it either way. Okay. And then for this second part, well, we have something very similar, right? What is this going to turn into? We're going to get the same type of thing when we sum over I. So we're going to get n2j product of sum over mu of the cosine q mu a. And then to be clear, this is different from the next part. We have delta k minus q. And so that's actually right. So I started with BKQ. Okay, so this is what BKQ looks like in momentum space. So just like in position space, how BKQ is only a few off-diagonal things, in momentum space, it's going to have a very particular structure too. It's going to be all zero except for these locations where one momentum is equal to the negative of the other momentum. So that means we can write Bij more specifically as, yeah, using our formula with the 1 over n squared. That's right. 1 over n squared, sum over k, q. BKQ e to the I k dot q xi e to the I q dot xj. And then we can substitute in this value that we have. Both pieces have a Kronecker delta. And we are going to sum over that Kronecker delta for one of these momentum values. I'm just going to pick to sum over Q. You know, we could pick either one, and we're just going to have a sum over some momentum. But the point is we can write Bij, its transformation, or, you know, its relationship between position and momentum space in terms of a sum over only one of these variables instead of over two. So we have 1 over n, because I get an n from both of these, so they're going to cancel out one of my n's. And then I have a sum over just the k, one of the k variables. And then I have a lambda from this first piece. And then I have a 2j times the cosine, 2j sum over nearest neighbors cosine of k mu a. And then e to the I k dot xi minus xj. And what have I done here? Well, you see I have e to the I k dot xi as before, but I went ahead and substituted minus k in for this q. And so now I get a minus xj from that. And for future, we're going to be calling this piece BK. And BK is a diagonal matrix that tells us about the structure of the momentum space, B matrix. Any questions about this so far? We're going to be doing a lot of these transformations, so I wanted to go into some more steps to make sure that you can follow them, because you'll be doing stuff like this in your homework too.
What's A?
A is the lattice spacing. And that's a useful thing to keep in mind, especially when we get to more of the RG later on. The lattice spacing does end up being important, because ultimately we are going to be coarse graining, so we'll be making our A bigger and bigger and bigger as we do the renormalization procedure. And so that's why you see the A here. This is going one more space in one of these directions. Okay, one other thing about B before we move on. When we looked at B in momentum space, we got this relation here. Where things were zero, really, unless you had k equals minus q. So if we were to think about what this B matrix actually looks like, and I'm ignoring k equals zero right now because it doesn't change the picture, but let's just think about if we decided to write out BKJ and we decided to order it with its plus k's and its minus k's, so that we had blocks of plus k and minus k. Then we say k must equal we say that we only have non-zero values when we are connecting a k to a minus k. So that means that the diagonal blocks for this type of matrix are going to be zero. And then I'm assuming that I ordered the k's in the same order for both the plus k and the minus k. So then what you would see for these blocks would you then get two diagonal blocks in the off-diagonal parts of the matrix. So that's what this BKQ looks like. We will be interested in actually the inverse of this B matrix as well. And B inverse KQ, because of its of this nice structure, you can actually say that B inverse, yeah, I'll just draw it here, looks very much the same. It's just these diagonals are just going to be 1 over each of the numbers that you had here. And you can kind of do a schematic yourself and look at what would happen if you multiplied these two things. Because if you multiplied these two things, you would get, for the first entry, you would have 0 times 0, and then you have this piece times this piece, and it's two diagonal matrices, so you'd just be multiplying the corresponding diagonals, so you just get 1s. So that would be your first block 1s. And then if you look at the result that would be down here, you would be multiplying this row times this column. Well, this row has this piece times this piece, which gives you an identity, and then you get 0 times 0. And so so you can, just by looking at the structure of the matrix, you can get B inverse from B. And you know, these entries, these diagonal entries, are given by BK. We can also say from this that Bij inverse is equal to 1 over n summation over k 1 over bk e to the ik dot xi minus xj. So we have these relations for B and B inverse. And I will say this prefactor up front is not very obvious to me. I can get it by just multiplying these things and seeing what normalizing factor I need, but it's actually not clear to me why it's 1 over n in this case. Okay, and then one more thing. If we look at our partition function, we see we do have a determinant of B as well. So if we want to move that into momentum space, knowing about this special structure that we have, well, what's the determinant of B? Any ideas?
Product of all the numbers in there.
Yes. It's just going to be the product over k of all the bk's. And you can see that because you see that for this, every row and every column only has a single number on it. So that means we could take a permutation matrix, multiply it, and just move all of these to a diagonal at that point. So those must be the eigenvalues. And so these BKs are the eigenvalues, so the determinant is simply going to be the product of all the eigenvalues. Just to make sure I don't don't erase any of these things, because these are how we take all the pieces of the partition function. Okay. So then let's figure out a couple of other things. One thing that I'm just going to write down the result on, but that you can figure out yourself, is that b squared is 1 over n times k. Bk squared e to the I k xi e to the minus I k x l. Right. So this needs to be a particular thing here. Yeah. And you can get that simply by taking your formula for Bij in terms of momentum space, which you have now, and then computing this. And then you can also, well, maybe we'll go ahead and do this one. So now what if I have phi t b times phi in real space? Well, first I'm going to write a summation over phi I b I j phi j. And then for each one of these, I'm going to get, I need to put in the formulas I have for all of them. And I didn't list this, but it is in your notes. For each of these phis, you get 1 over an. So that's for phi I and phi j. And then for the bij, we know we get another factor of 1 over n. And then we have our sum over ij. But now each one of these is going to come with its own momentum variable. So I'm going to say k, q, and k prime. So this is something you need to get used to with these Fourier transforms. You have a whole bunch of variables that you're going to be summing over. But because of the way that we've structured it, a lot of them end up being easy sums. And so part of the trick is looking at it the right way and making sure you see which are the easy sums to do. So we have a phi k e to the I k dot xi. That's our phi I now transformed into momentum space. And then I have bq e to the I q xi minus xj. And that is our formula for bij, right? We're going to have a bq, instead of bk, I'm calling it bq here, and then e to the iq xi minus xj. And then we're going to have our phi k prime, that's our third one, times e to the I k prime dot xj. And calling a n as just the volume of the system. I'm going to rewrite this as 1 over volume squared times n. And as it is right now, these spatial coordinates are going to be what we can sum over. Because notice phi and b and phi, well, we don't really know about them. We don't know their structure. So we're not going to be able to sum over those and get rid of them in the summation. What we can sum over are i's and j's. However, I and j right now, they're separated into all these different exponentials. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep k, q, k prime, since I can't really sum over those right now. And I'm going to put these pieces that have those dependences, but that do not have any ij dependences at the front. And then I'm going to put my summation over I and j over here. And then I'm going to rearrange these exponentials so that I have something in terms of xi and I have something in terms of xj. So I can do e to the I. So this there's a k attached to this xi, and then there's also a q attached to this xi. So k plus q dot xi. And then I can go to this one, and I have e to the I. Now what's attached to xj? There's a minus q here, and there's a plus k prime here. So I'm going to say k prime minus q dot xj.
Emily,
mm-hmm.
If you define an as the volume of the lattice,
yes,
system, then are we necessarily assuming one dimension?
No, because this big N was equal to like 2 times little n plus 1 to the d. Remember, this was definition on Wednesday, which I didn't remind us of. But this that big N is the total number of lattice sites. Oh, so I guess it should be a cubed probably. I think they call it a to the d. Yeah. So we should assume this should be valid for any of the dimensions. So a to the d is actually the correct normalization. I just forgot to write it in my notes entirely, but. Okay. These should look familiar from before. What are these going to turn into when we do these summations?
Deltas.
Yeah, they're Kronecker deltas. So there's two of them. So we're going to have an n squared because we get an n from each one of them. And then the first one, what is this Kronecker telling us?
K equals minus q.
Yes. So k is equal to minus q. And then what is this Kronecker telling us?
N prime equals.
Yes. K prime is equal to plus q. And so when we do this, all of a sudden we do have the ability to sum over these k's and q's because of those Kronekers. So this is really sort of the procedure you'll see going over and over again with these Fourier transforms. You need to sum over what you can sum over first to give you the deltas or the Kronekers, and then you can sum over those variables that are involved in the Kronecker deltas. So if I do this, then I'm going to, well, first of all, I'm just going to put the n squared up here, so I have n over v squared. And then, which way do I want it? I want this all to be summed in terms of k. So I could replace this one So I can replace this q, which way? Okay, so I'm going to replace this k prime with a q first, and then both of these q's will become minus k's. So I'm going to get phi k b minus k phi minus k. And so now we've gone to something much simpler. Well, this is pretty simple because it's written in matrix form, but you notice from here where we were summing over two variables in space, I can just sum over the k's, 1k here. And then bk, because it's a cosine, bk is equal to b minus k. And then we also have that phi minus k is equal to phi k star. And that just comes from here. If you have something in k space and you replace it with a minus k, this is the only complex piece, and you took I to minus I. So if you have a minus k of something, you just get it starred. So this is true in general. F of minus k is equal to F of k star. And if you think about it, that's good, because we started with these real space phis, and there was only one phi for each site in real space. But when we went to momentum space, because of these e to the I times some number, we had a bunch of complex numbers. So all of a sudden, it looks like we went from, say, n variables to 2n variables, because these phis are complex in momentum space. Well, we didn't really get twice as many independent things because of this relationship. So we still only have n independent quantities with these phi k's. Okay, so then I can just say that phi t b phi is equal to 1 over v a to the d times the summation of k bk, and then phi k. Go ahead and move both of these up. Another straightforward one, which I will leave to you, is the H transpose phi. In momentum space, this is equal to H a to the d phi zero. And you can imagine how that would be the case, because you're going to get e to the I k x, and that thing will just tell you that k must be equal to zero. So when you do this Fourier transform, you'll just get this. Are there any questions about what we have over here? I'm happy to answer them, because it's good to be firm on this stuff. Okay, and finally, I think the only thing we have left is that phi to the 4 term, right? So we'll go ahead and look at that one, which we can write as B times phi component I to the 4, which already, and I'm not going to, don't worry, I'm not going to actually do all of this written in this way, but already you can see there is going to be a huge number of even just spatial coordinates that we'd be summing over. Okay, did I? Yeah, that's right. Because we need the ith component of all of these. So we have all these things and they're multiplied, and then we do a sum at the end over I, where each one of these has an I at that point. And so the idea is, let's just start with one of them and figure out what that is in momentum space. And this is very similar to what we did over here, where we did phi t b phi. In fact, it's going to be a little bit easier than that, since it's just one of them. And so what we're going to get when we do that is 1 over v sum over k bk phi k e to the I k dot xi. And so notice, you know, we have a sum over the k's now, but we still have that I dependence because we still had an I here. And so this should be something that you're able to do now from looking at previous things. And so now if we do a sum over b phi to the 4th, with the i's, we're going to still have that one spatial component that we still have to sum over. But then now we need, for each one of these products, they're each going to look like one of these. So they each need to come with their own momentum variable. So we're going to have k1, k2, k3, and k4. And so then we have bk1, phi k1, e to the I k1 dot xi. Same for k2. Same for k3. Same for k4.
Mm-hmm. In the second line, you're summing over j, right?
Not I'm summing over j, that's right. So that's why I have a leftover I here.
Right, I'm just saying because in the sum it says I.
The sum, this should be an I and this should be a J, right? Well, there is a sum of I here.
Second line?
Oh, this, yeah, that's a problem. There we go, sum over J. Okay, and so at this stage, you know, using the knowledge we've gained from the past, what are we going to want to do? What can we sum over?
You sum over i's to get the delta function.
Exactly. Because we have i's in each of these exponentials, but we don't have any i's in these functions, right? So you know, if we were to combine all these, we would get e to the I k1 plus k2 plus k3 plus k4 dotted with xi, right? We could, if we combined all those exponential pieces. And so then if we have a summation over I, well, that is just going to be equal to our n times the Kronecker delta. And I am going to write it in delta function form at this point, because all of the momentum summed together, should be equal to zero in that case.
Mm-hmm. 1 over v to the fourth vector?
Right, did I? Oh yeah, I put it at the end because I forgot about it. Yes, there's a 1 over v to the 4 there. And then we get 1 n. So we have, if we think about this as 1 over n to the 4, a to the d to the 4, we're going to get rid of one of the n's. So we just have 1 over v cubed and then an extra a to the d. And then in this case, you know, there are probably many ways in which you could get the sums of all these k's to be equal to 0. So we're just going to keep the same sum of all those 4 k's. K2, BK3, BK4, and then we have all our field variables, phi K1, phi K2, phi K3, phi K4, times the delta function, or the Kronecker delta, that is, plus K2, plus K3, plus K4. And all of those need to be equal to 0. And so that's what our phi to the 4 term is equal to. And believe it or not, momentum space is more tractable than position space, even though this one doesn't look so great compared to a lot of the other ones. Okay, the only thing remaining, because that's really everything except for the measure. So how do we transform d to the n of phi? Well, like I said, phi k is complex. So we have this condition that phi of minus k is equal to phi of k star. And that's important because, again, it keeps us to have only n independent things. But it does mean we don't, we can't just say, you know, integral dn phi, because that would be integrating over too many things. That's not integrating over all the independent variables. That's actually integrating over 2n things that are redundant. And so for this particular integral, we're going to choose to integrate over 1 sine for each k. So for each phi of k, we're going to choose either phi k or phi minus k. So we represent this set of n k values as s, s prime, that is. And so that's what is called in the notes. And so the integrand is really, it's some JAC constant, which Giuseppe did calculate and that we'll use in the notes. I'm not going to get into it here. The way to do it, well, one way to do it at least, is to put some function in each of the integrands, integrate them both, and just figure out what those extra pieces should be equal to. But they aren't really so important to this. So, and then we're going to have a product of k's that are an element of the set S prime. And then we'll have, for each of those, the real part of that k, and then the imaginary part of that k. And of course, in the case of k equals 0, there's only one there. So we just do d phi 0. OK, and I think this is a good time for a break. And I'm happy to take questions, because we've done all of the momentum space stuff.
Can you explain that last bit about the measure again? I didn't really get.
Sure, yeah. So we have these new phi k's rather than the psi n's. And so we need to be able to integrate the phi k's instead of the psi n's. But the thing is, from the definition of something that's a function of k, you see that it's complex because you have this sum of e to the minus I whatever. And so you would end up with two n variables rather than just n variables. And so because of that, you don't truly get two n variables, because you have this relation that if you take a particular k and you do the minus of it, you actually get the star of the variable with the original k. So you only want to integrate over a sort of an independent, a basis of independent phi k's. And so there are a variety of ways you could choose to do it. The way that we're doing it in this case is taking, choosing half of the phi k's. So for every, let's say k is equal to, let's say k is equal to some 2, then we have a 2 or a minus 2. We can pick the minus 2 or we could pick the 2, but we just need to pick one of them. And so we're calling that a set S, where for every magnitude of k, we pick one or the other.
Yeah.
And so now we're doing a product of only the k's in that set. And then for the k's in that set, we do both the real part and the imaginary part of phi k in the integrand, because there, you know, there are two components to that field.
Okay. And the JAC, is that just like a...
Yeah, so if you want to know a little bit more of the details there, because it is a nice little trick. Basically, what you could do is you could integrate this function over d and phi. It's a Gaussian, so you can definitely integrate that. And then you can integrate its momentum space counterpart using this integrand that I defined, you know, the d phi 0 and then the product of k that's an element of S prime. And you know that these better be equal to each other when you've just transformed one. And so from that information, you can figure out, well, you're going to assume some prefactor out front, and then you can figure out what JAC actually is.
Yep. Yeah.
Or JC, I don't know what. Okay, so and so this ends up being 2 to the n minus 1 over 2 divided by VA to the D n over 2. But this is something specific to how we decided to define this integrand. So it's maybe not particularly special. There are different ways we could have split it up, but that's what's particular to this. And I was making use of the break to go ahead and write down the final result. Because now that we've written everything in terms of momentum variables, we can just put in the various pieces. So you see the phi to the 4 piece that we obtained. So you see the bk phi k absolute value squared piece that's over here from the Gaussian. There also ends up being a b squared and That came from up here. You have a B times a B in the real space action. And then there's the H field. So that's phi zero here, and so on. And so this piece, again, is the Gaussian model in momentum space. Now for the Gaussian model, you can actually get an exact solution to it because it is Gaussian. And we're going to do the renormalization group procedure on it, but I'm going to give you a little bit of the exact solution so that we can compare the results we get from one to the other. And so we're going to make use of that formula from Wednesday, where we have the Gaussian integral. Because what we'd like to do is integrate this piece. And so we can get that if we associate so we have bk times 1 minus beta bk. So let's say a is equal to, and there will be some constant there, bk times 1 minus beta bk times some constants. But to make sure I get those right, I actually first need to look at this piece, because this piece is going to be my omega vector. So for that I have beta a, sorry, let me, we have, we can write this still as an H vector, I believe. So we're going to say that omega is equal to the H vector And if that belongs to omega, then I am going to... Yeah, I'm just getting confused because there are all these extra things and I don't remember how they were associated. So in your notes, you're going to get the result that z is equal to the square root determinant of 2 beta a squared b over pi. That should be that first part. And then you're going to get the determinant of 2 pi as before. And then we are going to have b inverse and right, because that's right. We were thinking about this in real space again, and then we use the momentum space to help us out. Okay. No, I still have the real space action. Okay, that's why we can integrate this easily. Okay. So for solving the Gaussian model exactly, we're going to make use of this piece. Okay, so A is something like that. This is going to be my omega vector, but then it has beta times A attached to it. And then because of that, right, and so then, yeah, this is just A by itself, so this should have beta A squared over 2, or beta A squared. Okay. And is this one clearer? So this piece is going to look like this piece in the argument. And so this is my matrix A. I'm going to be integrating over these phis, which are real numbers. And this B beta A squared, I'm going to attach to this matrix. And then I have this vector with these constants. Okay. And so then, using this formula, we're going to put in a inverse, which is going to be a beta times a squared in the denominator. And then we're going to get b inverse times 1 minus beta b inverse. And then I need to close parentheses on the determinant. And now there's this vector piece, this e to the 1/2. So e to the 1/2 omega t a omega. So I'm going to have two of these omegas. So I should have beta squared, a squared, h. And then I have A inverse, and so the A squared will go away, So I'm going to have beta over a squared. And then I'm going to have B inverse times 1 minus beta B quantity inverse. And so then that matches 1/2 beta, no A's, H, H squared. And then I also have an N because I replaced this H tilde with H's and they're going to be N of those products. Okay, does everyone understand what I did here? This is just going back to the Gaussian model. And this is something we could have done before we had these momentum space relations. It's actually a little bit weird what we did. Because remember, we started out with the Ising model. And then we used this formula with associating omega with the spin field. And then we got to this and introduced this new variable, these phi, real space variables. And then we were able to sum over the spin variables and just get this field theory. But now it kind of looks like I just undid what I did. I just used this and went back over here. So it's kind of like, well, what's the point of that, right? Well, here's the thing. We managed to sum over the spin variables, and we didn't actually go back to where we started. Because remember, if we had really exactly what we began with, we would have this log in that action. And we wouldn't actually be able to do what we just did. Instead, what we've done is we've truncated the log. And so what we've done here is we've made a different type of approximation compared to mean field theory. Now we're actually going to get the same critical exponents as mean field theory. But because we came from a field theory, actually doing this with this Gaussian model allows us to calculate correlations and stuff like that that we couldn't get from just a normal field theory. So we actually did gain something, even though it looks like we just went one direction and back. We've just made a different type of approximation for this. Okay, so something about this, you know, I had this action, and then I just decided to blithely use this Gaussian integral formula as before. But remember, we took pains to emphasize that whatever matrix we use here has to be positive definite in order to actually do this integral. So we can only do this integral if 1 minus beta times b is positive definite. So this second step I took, actually, it has another condition. You know, we know b is positive definite, but we don't know if this 1 minus beta b is always positive definite. And this is actually something it ends up being physically important to this approximation. Because let's think about if this needs to be positive definite. If it needs to be positive definite, then if we think about the form of, remember, we know the eigenvalues. When we took time to go to momentum space, we learned the eigenvalues of this matrix B. And these are these BK eigenvalues. And these were equal to, well, I still have it there, lambda plus 2j times the sum over mu cosine of k mu a. And so because of that, we know that when k is equal to 0, cosine is 1. Cosine is the largest it could possibly be when k is equal to 0. So that means that all of these eigenvalues, well, we know they're greater than 0 because of that lambda. That was our construction. But they're all less than or equal to b0. And so because of that, we have that 1 minus beta bk, which are the eigenvalues of this matrix, are greater than or equal to 1 minus beta b0. And then if we solve for beta b0, that actually tells us that beta b0 must be less than, well, not solve for it, but we want these all to be positive. So then that means that this one, which is our worst case scenario, because this is our biggest thing, this needs to be positive. And so that means that this beta b0 must be less than 1. And so that's the same thing as saying that b0 over k is less than t, or t is greater than b0 over k, which is equal to lambda plus 2jd over k, which for this problem is our TC. And so when I do this this Gaussian and I just use this formula, I'm actually only getting results for this model when the temperature is greater than the critical temperature. There's another way to define a Gaussian model and look at it at below the critical temperature, and you are going to do that in your homework. And I think that is going to be out today. That's your second homework and last homework. And so that will allow you to look at things at quantities like beta and the critical exponents that are only defined below TC. But it sort of makes sense. With all of these, something different has to happen if you're above TC versus if you're below TC. Because when you're above TC, your magnetization is always 0. And then below, you get a very different behavior for TC, for magnetization. It has to change. And so you have to do a different calculation in order to get below TC for this. And let's go ahead and get one of the critical exponents since we have the partition function sitting right here. So we have a beta in this determinant, a beta in that one. So we can go ahead and get rid of those, get rid of a squareds, get rid of pi's. And if we do that and do some simplifications, what we're going to get is that z is equal to 2 to the n, this is in your notes, product over k, square root of 1 minus beta bk, e to the 1/2 beta, really should not confuse these, h squared n divided by b0 1 minus beta b0. And this is another simplification that was done that you can approve by Fourier transform, but I'm not going to do it here. So critical exponents. We need our reduced temperature, which, as I said, we're looking at T above TC for this problem. So T minus TC over TC. Which from here you can also get that beta is equal to beta C over 1 plus little t. And then if we want the free energy per particle, well, we can just do minus 1 over n kT times the log of Z. And if we're doing the log of Z, we're going to get three contributions because we have a product of three things. Do you have a question?
No.
Okay. And so then we're going to log of this minus log of this plus log of that. And so that's just minus kT log of 2. Because the n came down from the log, but then I divide by an n. And then I have plus beta n. Oh, I have a minus. Yeah, minus that. Yeah. And then I get the log of all these things. Which you can show that you can write this thing in terms of beta C squared times N H squared over 2 times little t. And I think there's an error in your notes right now that it has a 1 plus t up here. So I'm going to replace those when the lecture is done. I meant to do that beforehand. But that's what you should get for this term. And this term ends up being the only important one in order to figure out the susceptibility. Because to get the susceptibility, you need dm dh. M you get from minus the free energy with respect to H. And I do have that I should have a minus sign here. I'm not sure. I guess I'm missing some steps. I'm not sure. I do have a minus sign there, so maybe there.
Maybe you don't get a minus there, but you get it when you define t.
When I define t.
Yeah. So there's a plus on the first one, but when you do.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. When I get to this, yeah. Okay. Oh, maybe that's it. Yeah, yeah. I see. Okay. So then we have the derivative with respect to h. Of beta c squared n h squared over 2t. And nothing else has h dependence, so I can just do this term in order to get the magnetization. So that gives me beta c squared n h over t. And then chi is equal to dm dh. Sorry, should be dm, yeah, dm dh. And so then I just get beta c squared n over t. So chi goes as t to the minus 1, or gamma is equal to 1. And so I didn't really want to dwell too much on this exact solution of the Gaussian model, other than to get the critical exponents one way and then show you how to get them another way. But that's that. And then in the notes, there's also details for the specific heat. And that's that if you follow the notes, you'll see they obtain the result that for the specific heat, you get 2 minus d over 2 if d is less than 4, or 0 if d is greater than or equal to 4. And so you can see even here, that following this Gaussian model, it's not correct, but we're getting something slightly different from mean field theory for the alpha critical exponent. Because in mean field theory, we just always got 0. And so we have something that is dimension dependent, actually, when the dimensions are less than 4.
Mm-hmm. So if the second term in F is positive, then for the magnetization, shouldn't we also get minus?
Yeah, so I think what's going to happen is this is equal to minus this, and so then we'll have a minus minus.
Okay.
Emily? Mm-hmm. So we introduced the scalar lambda to make a matrix be positive definite.
Yes.
And we said it's an arbitrary parameter that doesn't depend, that affect our observables at all.
Yet, but now it shows up.
Yes. So it's still somehow.
Well, and that's what is coming from this approximation. When we truncated the theory at the phi squared term, we turned it into a different theory. And in that case, this lambda is involved more non-trivially than if we involved all the terms in that log. Now, it did not actually affect the universality, you know, for a Gaussian thing, but it did change the critical point, because the critical point is not a universal feature of theories.
Oh, okay.
The critical exponents are, the critical point is not.
It's not, okay.
So alpha, yes, I did not show how you would get this. This is from calculating the specific heat based on this partition function. And you'll see in the notes. The notes give the details on how to compute that. For that one, you have to take the derivative with respect to t from the beginning. And so this log ends up being important, and you have to do some approximations to get there. You'll replace this by an integral over k to make it an easier thing to compute.
example, when I compute the new order eta exponents, I just take like second derivative with respect to h, and then I do like 1 over z or something like that.
When you take what? Sorry?
Yeah, when I take like second derivative of z with respect to h, because mm-hmm. I get h like a source,
yeah,
will I get the correct eta?
So that gives you the susceptibility, the second derivative with respect to h. Oh, you're thinking about in terms of the source. So you're thinking like in the partition function type
yeah.
of thing. Yeah, yeah. So if you take that, then, I mean, it always looks clearer if you start with the Ising model that you began with, right? And you take the, if you take the derivative of the Ising model with respect to h, you bring down one spin. And so that's an average magnetization at that point. And then you take the second derivative, then you should get this susceptibility expression.
So is this susceptibility somehow related to like correlators, like connected?
So let's go back to the definition of the partition function. In fact, I'm just going to do it more schematically. All the energies, e to the minus, no, I should do it over sigma because I want to be specific to that. E to the minus beta, and then I have sigma sigma t j sigma. Let's do it that way. And then, and so that's e to the plus beta at that point. And then we have plus h vector times sigma. But actually, if we just think in terms of the spins alone, then I'm going to think about it I, J, sum over I, J, and then I have sum over I, H times sigma I, because that will allow me to then take the derivative with respect to H. So then, well, okay, so then I want D log of Z with respect to H, right? And so if I do that, I'm first of all going to get 1 over Z. That's the normalization that we want to have. And then if I take the derivative with respect to H, I'm also going to get, so I have still this sigma, but now I'm going to get a summation over all sigma I. And then I'm going to get the same thing that I had before. And so that makes sense for it to be the magnetization, because that's the average sigma. Well, if we divide it by 1 over n. And so now if you take a second derivative with respect to h, then for this, we're going to get another sigma. And so this goes to that other definition of the susceptibility, which is basically sigma I, sigma j, summation I, j. That is susceptibility observable.
Mm-hmm. So if I want to introduce like individual correlators and not their sums, I need to add a source to the partition function?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's basically, I see what you're saying, adding a source for the magnetic field is what to get these correlators.
Yeah, because this is sort of like summed, but if I don't want it summed, I just want like sigma I, sigma j without the sum, then I probably...
Oh, I see, yeah. So you could add a term. In fact, people do this, yeah. You could add a term that's just like sigma zero with h, and it's special h, you know, like h prime, and then you could take derivative with respect to that h prime.
So this h is not a source, this h is like...
Yeah, this h is the magnetic field which would affect all spins, not just one.